supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A former Philadelphia police officer now faces first-degree murder charges for fatally shooting a suspect who fled from a traffic stop. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
District Attorney Larry Krasner says it's the first time in about 20 years a Philadelphia police officer has been charged with murder for shooting a suspect.
I think it has been good politics here and elsewhere for a very long time for district attorneys who wanted to run for higher office, especially statewide office, in Philadelphia and in other areas, to be inappropriately close to a police union that might recommend them to all the other police unions across the state. I think that's how you go from being DA to being governor, which has happened. I think that's how you go from DA to being senator, which has happened.
Isaac Gardner of the Justice for David Jones Coalition says members of the group have fought since 2017 to make sure Pinnell faces charges. He says Jones' family is pleased to see the charges.
They were excited. They were overwhelmed with joy. Most of his family has moved out of the city of Philadelphia. They tried to come back because, you know, it was on short notice. They tried to come back today to express their love and consideration for everybody that stepped up for their family, because this should not have happened.
Pinnell's attorney, Fred Perry, tells a different story, saying his client is innocent.
He encountered someone who was armed with an unlawful pistol, pulled that pistol from his waist. A struggle ensued. Officer Pinnell was justified in his actions that night.
Fraternal Order of Police Union head John McNesby says the officers now know the DA is working against them, not with them.
Today's meritless indictment clearly illustrates a district attorney who has an anti-law enforcement agenda.
McNesby, who was surrounded by more than 100 police officers and their families, went on to say the indictment is unfair to those who are trying to uphold the law.
I don't believe any officer in this room leaves to go to work every day to take a life. It's just not what we're about. But we know how it's going to be for the coming years. When you do, we're going to be second guessed.
McNesby promised the FOP will support Pinnell and his family throughout the trial. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Confirmation hearings for U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh are underway. Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee tried and failed to stop the hearings before they could get started this morning. An attempt to pressure the Trump administration to release more than 100,000 pages of Kavanaugh's records from his time in the Bush White House. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker was among those who said the hearing should not continue until all of the documents are made available.
We have not received the documents that you have even called for. So, sir, based upon your own principles, your own values, I call for at least to have a debate or a vote on these issues and not for us to rush through this process.
Booker is widely viewed as a potential presidential contender in 2020. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo sat down with Booker and caught up with some of his colleagues recently. He offers this look at how the Garden State's junior senator maneuvers inside the Capitol and how this week could be a big moment for him on a big stage.
For members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, this week's hearings have already consumed their lives since Judge Kavanaugh was tapped to fill the open Supreme Court seat back in July. For Senator Cory Booker, that's meant hiring more staff to help pore over the more than 400,000 pages provided to the committee. He even hopped a plane to campaign for a fellow Democrat out in Nevada with a big book bag loaded down with reading material on the nominee.
We're preparing for this like everything's at stake, and trying to make sure that that limited time that I have to engage with the nominee is used as effectively as possible to bring out the issues that I hope Americans will focus on.
Booker says one of his biggest concerns is over Kavanaugh's past statements that seem to suggest he doesn't think sitting presidents can be indicted. But his list of concerns doesn't end there.
The protections on pre-existing conditions and elements of the Affordable Care Act. But it's so much more vast than that. The ability to marry who you want to marry. Voting rights. The power of corporations in America.
But Democrats are in the minority and don't have any procedural means to block Kavanaugh. Booker knows that. But he points to how his party was able to help defeat the GOP attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. He predicts a loud enough public outcry can also block Kavanaugh's nomination.
you had three Republican senators flip, and I think that was a driving force, was the activism and engagement of Americans.
But driving that engagement doesn't always endear a senator to colleagues. Booker turned heads when he became the first sitting senator in history to testify against a colleague when he formally urged his fellow senators to vote against Jeff Sessions' nomination as Attorney General. While South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham likes Booker, he didn't like when he broke precedent.
I think he has the right to do it. I don't think it's his finest moment. It's a further step in the wrong direction.
Another member of the Judiciary Committee, John Cornyn of Texas, the number two Senate Republican, viewed it as a political move.
I mean, it looks to me like he's got his sights set on 2020 and doing what he feels like he needs to do to be a contender.
Booker brushes aside the criticisms and likens testifying against Sessions to how he's preparing to question Kavanaugh this week.
I'm very proud of that, and I think that that was a similar moral moment.
That's in part because Booker says everything he predicted on Sessions has come true.
I knew exactly what he would do. I said it in my remarks, and it has happened already. And so sometimes in life, it's not about the outcome and winning. It's about saying, I will not be silent. I will not sit on the sidelines when what I believe is injustice is happening, and I'm going to speak up.
Even though Booker ruffled feathers by breaking Senate tradition, many Republicans like and respect him.
He's very ambitious, but at times he seems pretty rational, very rational.
Smart enough to know maximizing relationships is finding where your sweet spot is in terms of working together.
He's a very personable, likable individual, and you can see why he's been successful in politics.
That's Republican Senators John Thune of South Dakota, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, and Richard Shelby of Alabama. For Democrats, Booker is seen as a rising star. As Delaware Senator Chris Coons boarded the train that runs underneath the Capitol, he explained how with Booker, what you see is what you get.
One of the things I really value about our friendship and our working relationship is that Corey is someone who is every bit as funny and engaging and warm as he is capable of being sharp, focused, and purposeful. So he's a rare senator. And he's been a terrific addition to the Judiciary Committee.
Booker is now the top Democrat on the Africa subcommittee. And Kuhn says in spots like that, where there's no national coverage, is where he's really seen Booker shine.
And, you know, look, that's not glamorous work. It's not going to help you in Iowa or New Hampshire. I'm just throwing out one of several examples of ways in which I think Corey is doing the job, fighting for New Jersey, showing up at the Senate, doing his work here, rather than being, as you put it, distracted by the prospects of 2020.
As for this week's confirmation hearings, the spotlight will be on Booker and other potential 2020 White House aspirants. But the former mayor of Newark says he's not focused on the cameras.
These coming days will have a consequence on American history that will be felt for generations to come. And I've got to do my best in this moment to perform my job, which is spelled out in the Constitution.
As one of the newer and younger senators questioning Kavanaugh, Booker knows his time to press the nominee will come near the end. So he's planning accordingly and is ready to scrap some of what he's prepared if his more senior colleagues fail to ask certain questions or don't get suitable answers from the nominee.
So I think there'll be a lot of cleanup for those of us, as I am, the penultimate person in seniority.
While Kavanaugh will be under the intense spotlight all week long, Booker will share that stage with him in 30-minute increments as he questions him throughout the week. Political watchers will be looking to see if Booker helps or hurts a potential bid for the White House during his time in the limelight. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Women have filed 7 lawsuits against Stockton University in South Jersey this summer. They allege that both current and former students sexually assaulted them both on campus and off, and that the university should have done more to protect them. 5 of the lawsuits involve an off-campus fraternity that lost official recognition at Stockton years ago. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has been looking into the story and joins me now. And Joe, what do these women say happened while they were students at Stockton?
Well, as you said, Dave, 5 of them have filed lawsuits alleging members or former members of this fraternity, Pi Kappa Phi, sexually assaulted them either in their dorms on campus or in this off-campus fraternity house. In one case, a former student and frat brother allegedly sexually assaulted a girl in her dorm room, then posted a video of the assault to social media. In that case, charges were filed. The attorney in this case is a man named Robert Fuji. He represents the women who filed suits, the victims here. He says there was a pattern of behavior at PiCapify of drugging women and then waiting for them to become incapacitated and then sexually assaulting them. And he says Stockton should have done more to warn students about PiCapify and, you know, tell them ahead of time, here's the allegations against this fraternity, here's what you could be in for. And Fuji really says the school also should have done more to make sure that the fraternity stopped operating when it revoked its affiliation in 2010.
Not only the school allowed these things to happen, but these actors allowed these things to happen too. So it's unfortunate. And it really just seems like this. There's a climate and culture of systemic sexual assaults at Stockton. And also a lot of underage drinking. And people have said to me, well, you know, that goes on at every campus. We know it does, but not to this level.
Joe, how has Stockton responded to date?
Well, the university has referred questions on these cases to the Attorney General's office, and that is because Stockton is a state school, so it's represented by the Attorney General's office in these civil cases. And the Attorney General's office has said these cases are ongoing, so we're going to decline to comment. However, Stockton President Harvey Kesselman has addressed the lawsuits in a few written messages on the school's website. He said any student on our campus should have to fear for their safety is unacceptable and will not be tolerated. And he said, we try to build a culture where we respect and care for each other. We'll continue to work with law enforcement to hold predators accountable. Those messages haven't gone over well with all students, however. I talked to one, a senior named Moniba Khan, and she wondered why Stockton hadn't done more to prevent these assaults in the first place or to explain to students the details about why PiCapify had lost its affiliation and was the supposed no-go zone.
It should be clear, like, what does it mean to be unaffiliated? Why have they lost affiliation? You know, what's going on here? What is the problems that's facing the college, especially since Greek life is seen as such an important part of being in college for some people?
So here, Kesselman refers to the importance of protecting students on our campus. I guess from a legal point of view, what does on our campus mean? And does that pertain in this case to off-campus frat houses?
That's one of the big kind of interesting open questions about these cases. And so to try to answer it, I talked to a few legal experts who had different perspectives on this issue. So one attorney I spoke to, he's based in Michigan, he had much the same opinion as Moniba Khan, the student you just heard from, did, which is, why didn't Stockton University do more? It had the complaints against this fraternity and fraternity members. It was known on campus among students and faculty that PiCapify had a reputation for, let's say, unsavory conduct. So why didn't the university warn students about the details of what went on at this house? That's one school of thought. But then I also spoke to an attorney who regularly represents colleges and universities. That's Texas-based lawyer Scott Schneider. And he says, you know, maybe it's unreasonable to expect that universities can prevent every bad thing from happening to students on campus. And not only that, he says it's even more true for off-campus conduct. How is a university supposed to regulate things that don't happen within its own borders? Schneider likened universities to cities. He said they've become kind of these small little cities with their own police departments and amenities. And here's what he had to say about that.
I might go out for barbecue and somebody hits me in the head, and I don't immediately think, aha, the city should somehow be liable or responsible for this bad thing that happened to me.
And I'll add here that the Trump administration might agree with Schneider on that point. Last week, the New York Times reported that Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is considering new rules that would make colleges and universities liable only for conduct that took place on campus.
Meanwhile, where do these now seven suits stand at the moment?
Well, they're all in the pretrial phase in federal court in New Jersey, so we'll have to wait and see, you know, whether there's a settlement or whether they all go to trial. And by the way, I should add, all of these lawsuits came over the summer. There were two more filed today, and this is all happening in Stockton's first week of classes in the fall semester.
Thanks, Joe.
You got it.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez on Newsworks Tonight. Last week, in the wake of the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, last spring rather, Pennsylvania legislators considered a measure requiring those convicted of domestic abuse to immediately give up their guns. Under current law, they have 60 days to do so. The bill passed the Senate unanimously, but the House version has stalled, and as WHYY's Nina Feldman reports, advocates are pushing House members to take a vote.
Right now in Pennsylvania, if you're convicted of domestic violence, you don't have to turn your gun into police. You can give it to a friend or family member. If you're issued a protection from abuse order, a judge decides whether you give up your weapons. House Bill 2060 would change all that in a state where the rate of domestic violence victims dying of gunshots is rising. Melissa Carden with Moms Demand Action says the bill is simply about saving lives.
Domestic violence is a public health issue, and it's not a partisan issue. So this is really about domestic violence more than it's about gun rights.
But legislators didn't see it that way. After the Senate passed its version of the bill, a House committee approved its version in June. But the measure never came up for a vote on the House floor. State Rep. Leanne Krueger-Branke co-sponsored the bill.
The gun lobbyists have a stranglehold on our state legislature, and it's time for people to say no more.
Kim Stolfer of Firearms Owners Against Crime said his group agreed to stay neutral on the Senate bill, but the House version was different. The group says it's unrealistic for people to turn over their guns within 24 hours, and penalties for missing that deadline are too strict. Stolfer says that if the bill doesn't change, his group won't support it.
We have 1.17 million people with a license to carry, let alone 5 million total gun owners in Pennsylvania. If we can get the message out, it'll be a painful year for anyone who votes for this.
It's up to House GOP leaders to decide whether to bring the bill for a vote before the end of the legislative session. Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
Republican House leaders did not respond to a request for comment today. The life and times of Chadsford, Pennsylvania native, artist Andrew Wyeth, will be revealed at a screening of the documentary Wyeth tomorrow evening at the Kimmel. Also on WHYY TV 12 American Masters this Friday evening at 10, and then next Wednesday at the Ambler Theater at 7. Joining me with a preview of Wyeth is the film's director, Glenn Holston. Glenn, welcome back to Newsworks tonight.
So happy to be here.
What first piqued your curiosity to embark on this project?
Well, when I was a young filmmaker, I had been engaged to assist on a film about Andrew Wyeth. I was 20-something, and there was a film called Snow Hill that the painter Beau Bartlett created, commissioned by Betsy Wyeth, Andrew's wife. And so I was joined him on that as a writer and sort of an organizer of material, and that was my first introduction into Wyeth world, into Chadsford. And driving into Chadsford, which I hadn't done before then, was like driving into the landscape of one of Mr. Wyeth's paintings. It was really, this whole project has feels like I've been stepping into art history.
And our step in is facilitated by early on in the film, there is a curator, Wanda Korn, a professor emeritus of art history at Stanford, and she reveals what she thought she knew about Wyeth and Betsy until she met them. Let's listen.
I think I somehow thought Andrew Wyeth would be more of a bumpkin or a hermit or a farmer type, but what I found was somebody who served me the strongest cocktail I'd had in a long time, who made me laugh. And I found his wife beautiful, but also very clearly I was going to have to win her approval because she wanted only the best for Andrew Wyeth. But I also came away thinking this is a much more complicated and interesting artist than I think I know from what's been written about him in the past.
And off we go, and I sure wanted to learn more about him. Long before he was mixing cocktails or even dating his wife, he was his father's son.
That's right. N.C. Wyeth is the father of Andrew Wyeth, and N.C. Wyeth was a very famous illustrator and a fine, fine painter in his own right. But he taught Andrew Wyeth how to paint. And
He taught him everything. He was homeschooled by his father.
Yes, he was homeschooled. He taught him not only how to paint, but how to approach life and how to approach the world around him. I think he instilled in Andrew Wyeth this passion that he had for Chadsford. But what Andrew Wyeth did was, in Chadsford, he found communities to focus on and kind of obsess over and paint over and over and over again. He did the same thing in Maine with the Olson family, Christina.
The Kerners in Chadsford and then the Olson. Christina is the subject of perhaps his most famous painting.
Yeah, Christina's World is that painting that we've all seen sort of taken riffs on over and over again. You know, it was the first postcard I bought when I was a teenager at MoMA. It's a terrific painting, and it's given really a careful analysis in our film on what makes it, what's the hold, and what does it grab people.
And part of the acclaim is that one can't even necessarily articulate to oneself what draws one in with a work of Andrew Wyeth, and it played to such popular acclaim. Why was it a more complicated relationship with art critics at the time?
I think the nature of art criticism in this country, at least, if someone's popular, they become suspicious. So Andrew Wyeth had these incredibly attended shows, wildly popular, 5,000 people a day at the Whitney. And so he was breaking records everywhere. And then also his works were selling for record amounts of dollars. Then in the 60s, abstract expressionism came in, and it was a very different kind of
look. De Kooning and Pollock.
And I think Andrew, instead of sort of swimming in the same sort of channels as those artists, was set apart. And it was definitely another pivotal moment in his career. And he decided just to sort of pursue his own work, which I find so inspiring as a maker of things, despite what someone says about your work or how you should be working or what the current trends are. You just say, this is what I'm doing because this is what I know how to do, and this is what is continually interesting to me.
I believe he passed in 2009, and in the final decade of his life, there was a new appreciation for his work.
Right. This film is part of a sea of reexamining of Andrew Wyeth. There was a bunch of scholars who gathered together at an art historians convention, and a book came out of it called Rethinking Andrew Wyeth. There's a couple of shows that have happened. The Brandywine River Museum of Art just had a Wyeth in retrospect show that was also a huge hit in Seattle. So my hope is that this film does what those things have all done, which is make someone who might think that they know this artist re-examine their ideas about who Andrew Wyeth is and really find many, many more levels to his work.
Was it a challenge to get his sons, Jamie and Nicholas, to hold forth?
It really wasn't. I feel like this is the time for Andrew Wyeth's story to be told in total. I mean, it's been a few years since his death, and I think everyone is sort of ready. And I find that with films. You don't necessarily want to go in and do something like after the tragedy or immediately after. People need time to reflect, to mourn, and I think...
And almost forget in a way, and then come back to it.
And I think they wanted to honor their father.
Let's note that you and I have barely had time for breathing room, but our listeners can hear a full hour tomorrow morning at 10 with Marty Moskowitz on Radio Times, where you'll hopefully be even more expansive in describing your work and this film. Thank you so much for your time on Newsworks Tonight.
Certainly is my pleasure.
Glenn Holston is director of Wyeth. There'll be a screening tomorrow night at the Kimmel. If you missed that opportunity, Friday evening at 10 on WHYY-TV, American Masters, and then next Wednesday at the Ambler Theater at 7. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.